Hello and welcome back to Big Mouth. We've had our week off while Andrew went to Glastonbury and now we're back and normal service is resumed. I'm Sian Pattenden and Andrew Harrison is covered in twigs and dried otter bitter like the Port Elliot Stig of the Dump. Hello, Andrew.
It was brilliant, needless to say. I had a fantastic time. We recorded an emergency sort of done on the iPhone bitty podcast, which we put out last week, which was full of noise and background. But I have to issue a correction. We saw the amazing Acid Mother's Temple.
Oh, yeah.
Who are brilliant and wild and insane. And I'm on the podcast going, yeah, and they've got this great female guitarist who looks like a kind of psychedelic Mary Portas. Turns out psychedelic Mary Portas is a chap and he's carrying off amazingly well. So I'm all in for psychedelic Mary Porter's realness on the Acid Mother's Temple. What else? Jeff Goldblum's patter. Brilliant. Jeff Goldblum saying, is there anybody here from Sunderland? I believe you're called Mackams. The stem went down very, very well.
Did he play?
He did his jazz thing.
Oh, OK, yeah. What's he like?
It was basically what Ian Harrison called their barfly jazz. The kind of thing you expect on a Sunday afternoon when there's a lot of people avoiding their families. But two people did turn up dressed as inflatable Tyrannosaurus Rexes to frighten him. And they did finish with a flourish of the Jurassic Park theme in a jazz style. So that was good. What else? And something I thought was really nice. It was a really classy bit. After the Chemical Brothers, they put up a big thing of Keith Flint. A big in memoriam for Keith. Yeah. And that got big cheers.
Yes.
And so it was absolutely lovely.
Did Chris Martin keep popping up and interrupting your podcast?
He was in my tent, actually. he was on the train from Castle Carey. He produced his acoustic guitar. Yeah. Yes, he was the special guest Florence Machine of this year.
Right.
Appearing with everybody.
Yeah, I saw.
Little goes a long way.
Mm, absolutely. Who's joining us today, Andrew Harrison?
Glad you asked me, Sian. We have two hardy Big Mouth perennials with us today. Strictly Kev, a.k.a. DJ Food, or as we know him, Kev. Began as a stalwart of the Colcut Ninja Tune stable, and he grew into a master of cinematic jazz and electronic breaks with a discerning listener. He's also perfected his own style of audiovisual DJing, where he deconstructs an artist or label and rebuilds it in his own style. He's currently touring an epic Kraftwerk show of classics, covers and curios, all with a K, of course.
Indeed.
As if you're working for Kerrang. And he's a proper 2000 AD and psychedelic space nut, so he fits in right here. Hello, Kev. Welcome back.
Hi, Andrew.
How are you doing?
I'm good, yeah.
Tell us about this Kraftwerk show, then.
Oh, that's just me trying to do a different take on Kraftwerk. You know, I've seen the show and everyone's seen the show, but they're obviously so influential that people have covered them in really, really weird styles, jazz styles.
Way beyond Senor Coconut, doesn't it?
Oh, way before, yeah. Mm. And also a lot of people have sampled them heavily and a lot of people have been influenced by them. So I mix all that together, but a few cheeky mashups as well.
Excellent. Because that Kraftwerk's own show, which is amazing, has got a little bit repetitive, I feel, seeing they've been touring the same 3D thing for, what is it, 10 years?
Yeah, well, they've kind of been recycling their career for 20 or more.
They have, yeah.
You know, or actually, even longer than that, maybe nearly 30, since the mix, really.
Basically,
they haven't really done much new stuff.
You're playing Blue Dot at Jodrell Bank, aren't you?
I am.
Is that going to be the Kraftwerk set or just a random Kev set?
That's actually a Boards of Canada set.
Oh, wow.
Which is all Boards of Canada and their influences and people they've sampled and things like that.
I believe you're actually throwing forward to things we're going to be discussing later in the
show.
Right. Excellent professional broadcasting. Kev was part of the Ninja Tune Solid Steel family for years, and he did a giant mix of the Warp catalogue in the mid-90s, and we're going to be talking about Warp's 30th anniversary later in the show. But before we move on, I have to ask you, why have you not put out a mix called Strictly Come Dancing yet? Because you need to.
Oh, yes, I should do.
Also returning to Big Mouth this week is Luke Turner, co-founder of The Quietest, the wisdom of peculiar and disturbing music, and author of the brilliant Out of the Woods, in which he wrestles with his sexuality among the hornbeams of the Essex borders. I like saying that. It's just been nominated for the 2019 Wainwright Prize as well. Congratulations, Luke.
Thank you.
How was your Glastonbury? Heard you were there with Chris Martin over on the...
Thankfully, I didn't encounter Chris Martin. Oh, he didn't do a guest spot.
I'd love to hear him do a guest spot in the middle of your book.
I'll just start groaning. It's very I was up at the Crow's Nest, which is my sort of new favourite bit of the festival, up on the hill, doing a bit of an Out of the Woods reading with a fairly serious hit of heat stroke, which meant it was a bit cosmic. I had a great time. It's so different now.
Is it?
From when I used to... I mean, I remember in the 90s when I was a kid, it was all quite heavy and there was people getting robbed everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. Then in the early 2000s, it sort of lost it. It was just sort of slightly older people, and it seemed to have lost a lot of the thrill. And then now, I just loved it. It was the scale of the thing is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
There's no more crusties. I like that. I didn't see hardly any crusties, but there's loads of out gay people partying.
Right,
and I was kind of like, crusties, loads of out gay people having a great time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm into that. But I really enjoyed it. It was very different from how it had been before.
What was better, the 15-year-old kid doing, is it Tiago Silva with Dave?
Yeah.
Or the red arrows fly past?
Oh, that's...
sound very Glastonbury, doesn't
now,
it?
Now, see, that's... I think that kid doing... I mean, I didn't see it in IRL, but I saw it on the internet yesterday about three times to cheer me up, and it was absolutely incredible. And that was, you know, that was... One of the things I thought was amazing about the festival is that kind of all that siloing of music which kind of happened when I was a teenager between Britpop and dance music or whatever, it seems to have broken, and kids were just into everything. And he was so great. But, you know, for me, when I was feeling terrible on Saturday, wanting to go home, and was going home, when the red arrows came down the valley, that was, I mean, you know, as an aviation enthusiast, I was pleased that I was added to my Glastonbury.
Do you think the red arrows ought to do a pride fly past with the rainbow bit on it?
Oh,
that would be amazing.
Yeah, they could do, couldn't they?
Fantastic, yeah.
Luke, you're also a massive Warp head, so I bet you'll be looking forward to our 30 years of the Sheffield Bleep Foundry later on. We'll also be looking at the Channel 4 HBO adaptation of Catch-22, Have They Filmed the Unfilmable? And Tom York's new album, Anima, which dropped on Thursday night just as everyone who wanted it was stuffing sleeping bags into a Tesco bag for life. These things and more after a reminder from Andrew.
Those exclusive Big Mouth mugs are on their way to our top-tier Patreon backers, and you can get one too if you sign up to support our valuable work. Help us with our studio bills to the tune of a mere fiver a month, and you will get every edition of Big Mouth a day early, direct to your own secret private RSS link. And you'll get the exclusive extra bit where our guests stick around for a bit longer as well. This week it's Glastonbury come down time, so we're sharing our best and worst festival experiences. But if you pledge us £10 a month, you'll get all that plus the Big Mouth mug, perfect for showing off your erudition and good taste in the home or workplace. Search Patreon Big Mouth to find out how to support us. All we're saying is buy us a pint. OK, let's get into that Warp 30th birthday. The preemptive label of British Electronica was founded in Sheffield in 1989 by Fon Records workers Steve Beckett and Rob Mitchell, plus Robert Gordon, who'd produced Crush, Age of Chance and Pot Will Eat Itself, all the good stuff. Over the years, they've brought us everything from LFO and Nightmares on Wax to Aphex Twin, Boards of Canada and Flying Lotus, while Warp Films are behind Ben Wheatley's Kill List, Paddy Considine's Tyrannosaur, Chris Morris's Four Lions and some of Shane Meadows' best work. Though the label moved to London in 2000 and Rob Mitchell sadly died in 2001, Warp has remained the go-to outfit for electronics that stretch your ears, even though the famous purple record bags disappeared years ago. Before we talk about what Warp means to ravers and chin-strokers alike and recommend some music, we've all chosen our own personal favourite Warp track, and here they are. Emotions in my head, That was my choice, Nightmares on Wax with Dextrous, then Aphex Twin with Analog Bubble Bath 1, which wasn't actually on Warp, but we're going to talk about that in a minute. Sean chose that one. Then Luke Turner's choice of LFO with Freak, and finally Broadcast and the Focus Group with The Bee Colony, as chosen by Strictly Kev. The whole arc of Warp is there. Kev, why is Warp a special label? You have an intimate relationship with it. What makes it special?
That they've survived for 30 years and they've got at least a sort of good 50% of their original roster still present and still doing something really interesting. You know, Orteca, Boards of Canada, Nightmares on Wax.
Yeah.
Plaid, obviously, you know, were part of Black Dog, Aphex. I mean, there's not many people that aren't around from the early days and the golden era of Warp, I think. You know, plus they've still managed to carry on. They've got people like Flying Lotus and they've managed to stay up to date.
Yeah.
But they've kept their history intact. They've still got Designers Republic working with them in some capacity visually. And they've got that strong identity.
Because the gag early on was it stood for We Are Reasonable People, didn't it? And actually, it turns out they actually are reasonable people. Yeah. It doesn't engender a bit of loyalty. It is, I mean, there aren't very many labels in the history of pop music where you just trust the label, you buy it because it's on the label. Yeah. I was like that with Two Tone, ZTT, you know, Factory mostly. And the same with Warp, certainly in the first three or four years, I would just see the record pack and just buy it.
Yeah, it's a mark of quality. You trust them. If you've never heard of the artist, but it's on Warp, you will go and buy that. Yeah. Or you will at least listen to it.
You've chosen some of your favourites there, but I mean, I think the track that you pulled out was from a more recent one, Broadcast and the Focus Group, The Bee Colony. Yeah. Tell us about them and it.
Well, that's the sort of ultimate collaboration with the Focus Group is Julian House from Ghostbox Records, and they were very. He was very entwined with the Broadcast designing all their sleeves. So that was a bit of a weird left turn for Warp. It was them sort of getting onto the sort of Hauntology bandwagon, as it were, early on. And I think it's one of Broadcast's sort of weirdest works, but that track is one of their best pop works. It's the one that stands out in the whole album, which is quite of a weird, quite avant-garde collage, but it's beautiful. I mean, really interestingly constructed record with all sorts of weird time signatures going on. And obviously after that, Trish passed quite soon and it was all ended, but
I think we've got a bit more Broadcast later as well. We've put together a playlist of Warp on Big Mouth. So if new neophytes can investigate it and find out what they've been missing. Luke Turner, Warp are quite central to the whole Quietus thing, aren't they? They staked out a place for challenging oddball, both musical but also kind of sonically exploratory.
Yeah, I think that's one of those key labels for us, really. Probably more John than me, to be honest. But I see them as, you know, Mute's my kind of beloved label all the time. And I sort of see Warp as, like you say, the label you can trust, like Mute were. And I think Warp kind of took electronic music in the 90s and in the same way as Mute did in the 80s and late 70s. I think for me, that it was like I was talking about, with that kind of like fragmentation of music. And when I was a kid at school, no one was into Warp stuff at all. It was like, it was odd. No one was into Aphex or anything like that. Everyone was into Jungle or Britpop. It was this sort of weird thing. So I came to Warp quite late, and it was that's why I picked Freak, really, because that was such a gateway for me for discovering all of that music.
Yeah, and that is quite an uncompromising. I mean, remember the sort of the tale about when LFO by LFO was a hit, and the consternation on Radio 1 that a record like this should be allowed to be put out, let alone play on the radio. And they still found a way of going even further with it in a thing that is a dance track, but is almost kind of, you know, a challenge to you as well as a groover.
Yeah, and it was sort of people like Errol Alcorn started playing that when I was first going into clubs in London, and it just was one of those sort of like, what is this? I need to find it out and dive in. Really,
it's quite brutal, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's what I mean. Sometimes I think some of that Warp stuff is a little polite for me. Like I like my dance music to be quite brutal, and Freak definitely does that, but in a very sexy way as well. Yeah. I think.
Do you think they're an especially northern label? Because, I mean, when they appeared, I was a student in Leeds, and these records would be sold primarily locally, and it was dead exciting that you were hearing this noise that was from a very familiar town.
I mean, I've read a quote by Jarvis Cocker the other day, which I might have completely got slightly... I'm slightly paraphrasing, but he said, you know, everyone wants to identify this music with Sheffield and go on about steam hammers, but if something's from Brighton, you don't say it sounds like fish and chips or something, something like that.
I would love there to be a Brighton label. Actually, you know what? I mean, the Brighton labels are a bit fish and chippy and a bit seaside-y, aren't they? Kind of, you know, Wall of Sound and Skins. They've got a bit of...
Bit vinegary.
Well, they've got a kind of end of the pier, roll up and let's have fun slightly.
I think it's sort of candy floss, is it?
I think Jarvis is wrong there. It's a bold person who says Jarvis is wrong. I think he's wrong about that. Anyway,
but then again, I sort of really associate Aphex with Cornwall, and John Doran's just who I do Quietus with just won a prize for his radio program about Aphex and Cornish mythology.
Yeah,
and then Richard King's new book, The Lark Ascending, he talks a lot about the English pastoral and boards of Canada. So I think that's one of the interesting things I find about Warp. It sort of sounds British, but from all over the place. And I really like that. It's not just urban music. It sounds like it's from everywhere.
The thing about Cornwall, though, of course, it's the north of the south, isn't it, really? It's the north of the south.
You could argue that, yeah.
I'm arguing that right now.
Yes. You are determined on analogue theory.
You really want to argue that.
Sean, you chose Analogue Bubble Bath 1 by Aphex Twin. There are several Analogue Bubble Baths.
There are three, are there?
Yeah. At least three, possibly more.
Yeah. Well, two is Didgeridoo, which is the really fast, crazy Didgeridoo song that most people know him for.
Yeah.
And it actually wasn't on Warp, but it just sounds that way, doesn't it? It just sounds part of that whole thing.
Yeah, I think my sad sort of academic argument was that Aphex Twin could be on, you know, EMI, you know, Universal, and he'd still sound like a Warp record.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's that Warp has followed him because he kind of embodies Warp for me. LFO and Aphex Twin embody Warp for me.
Yeah, and it is such a... I don't think anybody has surpassed it for basic, incredible beauty from very simple little recipe.
Yeah.
And it just shows you the interesting thing they did where they were kind of the first dance label to intuit that the listeners were going to get older and they might want to listen at home, possibly with a remedial homemade cigarette. And they kind of launched the Artificial Intelligence series, which had a load of great ambient stuff on it.
Yeah.
And it, you know, unlike most dance labels, which continue to just pump out banger after banger, they have grown up.
Yeah.
But do you not think they were like that from the start? There is an ambient quality at the start. I think they knew that you would want, you maybe want one for the banging and for the dancing, and then you want the chill out stuff. I always thought it fused together quite well, quite mature.
Yeah, but it enabled them to grow up with the listeners. And so, that, you know, the older you get, I mean, I think when I used to edit Mixmag years ago, we kind of had this idea that there was like a continuum of readers, and at one end was a gurning, nutty raver, and at the other end was a bald guy with a record bag sort of stroking his chin. But actually, everybody was somewhere on that continuum, and inside every raver was a bit of a crate digger, and vice versa. Inside every crate digger was somebody who actually just really wanted to take their top off and sweat themselves down to the size of an Oxo cube.
But also they had early pop success, didn't they? Because they had LFO and Tricky Disco had pop hits, which gave them the money to actually come out of that indie label thing and sign people like Aphex and Orteca and B12 and Black Dog, and then that whole artificial intelligence era of the early 90s was a kind of benefit of that early pop success, is that they had the money to sign these people and the foresight, obviously.
Now, I managed to miss the NCS Radio weekend of Warp on the radio. Kev, did you dip in?
Well, yeah, post-weekend.
Yes.
Yeah, I was actually away the whole weekend.
The idea that you could...
Monday was downloading, where's the torrents?
So what were your picks? Pops.
Boards of Canada were really good. They did a two-hour mix, which is incredibly rare for them. They don't do mixes. They haven't since the 90s. And they put in loads of their influences, plus a few little gems from their back catalogue, which were beautiful to sort of extract and think, oh, look, there's a weird version of Aquarius with Imagination's Just as an Illusion and Slave to the Rhythm mixed over the top, which was a real highlight moment.
Fantastic.
And there was... Oh, Orteca went back into their pre-warp tapes of ravey techno, all their demos, and did 2 hours of that, which I haven't listened to yet, but
is
going to be definitely worth it.
So basically, Warp fans themselves in 1989, they're still paying attention 30 years later, but we're as far from the foundation of Warp as Warp was, the foundation of Warp was from basically the second, from Cliff Richard, really. It's a 30-year equidistance, isn't it? It's astonishing.
Make us feel old, Andrew.
Well, but feeling old has changed, hasn't it? You sort of don't age the way that, say, our parents or grandparents did.
50's the new 40.
50's the new 40. Well, where I was going with that was, it's not unfeasible to imagine a 50th anniversary of Warp Records.
No, absolutely not.
Because they've kind of located themselves both in the world of dance music, but also in the world of avant-garde composery stuff, and of course films.
Yeah.
That will provide longevity. We've got some more recommendations from each of the guests. Let's have a listen to these. Yeah. That was Sabres of Paradise with Theme from Haunted Dancehall, as chosen by Sian. Luke's choice of Broadcast, them again, with Black Cat from Tender Buttons. Then Boards of Canada, them again, with Reach for the Dead from Tomorrow's Harvest, as selected by Strictly Kev. And finally, my choice, which is Black Dog Productions, with 3/4 Heart, or is it 3/4 Heart? I've never really known, from Bites, their early compilation for Warp. Sian, why Theme and why Haunted Dancehall?
I think this is when Warp veered, which is why I thought I'd put it in as a spanner in the works. When a kind of big beat Andrew Weatherall came in, as much as he'd hate to be described as that, but wanted to do something weirder with what was the sort of popular music of the time. He's obviously famous for remixes, Primal Scream, all that sort of stuff. But Sabres of Paradise are the avant-garde version of that. And I just played it to death, that album. I'm not quite sure why, to which point flatmate at the time just went, stop playing Theme by Sabres of Paradise. There's something about, I liked it because it fused popular and avant-garde. It was something different. Yes, the idea of you want something weird to dance to sometimes, don't you? If you want to go out and listen to it, it's got to have the beat, but then it's got to have interesting things coming through. So it's quite, as an album, I don't know people would call it cohesive because it is a bit all over the place, but somehow I quite like that of the sort of scattergun approach that Warp would just go and make the record, we'll put it out. And there's something about the freedom of that which is really nice. It's not like listening to a Fatboy Slim record.
And it's also a mega spy theme, basically, isn't it?
Yes. yes, that particular track is.
You've been told off for playing Theme. I've been told off for stop whistling Wilmot by Sabres in the Kitchen. Stop going. it being a mega earworm.
Yeah,
Luke,
yeah.
You chose the album that you're recommending is Tender Buttons by Broadcast, and the track we had was Black Cat. Tell us, they're a recurring theme on this show, apparently. Tell us why you love that one.
Well, they're just an amazing, weird pop band, aren't they, Broadcast? And Black Cat is a brilliant, brilliant pop song. I love that group, and I saw them 1 year live. And it was one of the best gigs I ever saw, really, at the start, opening ATP. And I think Warp have a sort of slightly weird history with bands, don't they? Because they put out Maximo Park, and I've still not forgiven them for that. Yeah. Absolutely rancid band. And there was that sort of odd time when they put out Grizzly Bear, which I really like those Grizzly Bear records on Warp. But then Broadcast sort of were in a different, you know, you were talking about this sort of ambient wing of Warp, and they almost slightly brush on that in a way. You know, like Kev was saying about Hauntology, you know, so much music that's kind of hauntological is quite bad, and it's just sort of...
Noises and an old man muttering.
Yeah, exactly. It's just not, you know, public information film. And
Charlie says you're going to die.
Yeah, and it's just a bit rubbish, whereas Broadcast sort of took those little sonic hints and little sort of Geiger pulses and radio transmission sounds and made it sound really modern, which I thought was wonderful. I love it. It would be in my favourite albums, I think.
It's such a shame about Paul Trish, because their potential future, you know, the Chernobyl, Sonny and Cher, would be just absolutely good, because they had all of that.
I really felt with that album... And when I saw them at that gig, which wasn't long before she died, that they were sort of on the way to doing something that could really cross over in an incredible way. And it's tragic that would never happen now.
Absolutely. Kev, there's an argument that Boards of Canada are basically, in some respects, Warp's biggest artist now. They're one of the world's most influential. You just mentioned you're doing a grand smorgasbord of them. What is it that makes them that? What have they got to? What places have they reached that other people haven't?
They've got that mystery that Aphex had initially, where, you know, they didn't reveal that they were brothers. They don't really do interviews that much. They've retained that mystery in our sort of social media saturated world, you know. And, you know, again, forerunners of that hauntological movement, really, by default, because they tap into that nostalgia of youth. You listen to their songs and you hear little things that you kind of think that you remember, but it all sounds familiar or from some place way back in time. They've tapped into that.
Yeah.
And they were very, very prescient on this Tomorrow's Harvest album, in that they tapped into the whole sort of Italian giallo horror soundtrack, synthy 80s movement, just as that whole horror reissue movement was coming out. Labels like Death Waltz were reissuing obscure 80s synth soundtracks. You know, everyone had done library music from the 70s and funk soundtracks and obscurities, and Boards were right in there with this weird electronic synth thing that, again, you like a sort of offshoot of a Halloween John Carpenter soundtrack. They had that in there and, you know, they'd renewed themselves again.
You really need to see In Fabric, this film that we reviewed a couple of weeks ago. It's right up your street.
I'm gutted that wasn't here 2 weeks ago.
Seriously. In fact, everybody listening has to watch it, don't they? My choice was Black Dog, the aforementioned. Two of them are now in Plaid. And I just love this album, Bites, which is a compilation of all the things they put out under a million different identities. And this particular one, just because it's so symphonic and it's so beautifully arranged and it's so poignant. And it was everything about where Warp was starting to go, to sort of, you know, that this stuff is, you know, it's orchestral, but also rooted in the rave and it's rooted in weird noises. And this one I hammer, I think, more than anything else. So we've made a Spotify playlist of all these Warp tracks and it's on our Facebook page. Have a listen and expand your brain.
Expand it now. Right, on to Catch 22. In parts directed, produced and starring George Clooney, Hulu's miniseries is, of course, an adaptation of Joseph Heller's anti-war novel of 1961, described by Hulu as the story of the incomparable Artful Dodger, Yossarian, a US Army Air Forces bombardier in World War II who is furious because thousands of people he has never met are trying to kill him. Does it do the novel justice after 1970s Mike Nichols' oft-panned movie adaptation? Or, let's be glib, is it just MASH with George Clooney in a different war? Here's the trailer.
Doc, you can ground me if I'm crazy, right?
Oh, sure, I have to. I have to ground anyone who's crazy.
Then ground me. I'm crazy.
You're not crazy.
Why not?
Catch 22. As soon as you ask to get out of combat duty, you're no longer crazy, and so you have to fly more missions.
That's some catch, that Catch 22.
It's the best there is.
Read me back the last line.
Read me back the last line.
Not my last line, somebody else's.
Read me back the last line.
That's my last line again.
Oh, no, sir, that's my last line. I read it to you just a moment ago.
I think you and I are the only two sane people on this base.
I have decided to raise the mission count from 25 to 30. We're gonna win this thing. Hip, hip.
It doesn't make a difference who wins the war to someone who's dead.
It's all a numbers game. And when your number's up, your number's up.
This is war.
Hello.
War concentrates power in the hands of those most likely to abuse it.
Well, that was the agreement we had. 500 goats.
War is not about profits, son.
Absolutely, sir, not only.
I've flown more missions than anybody on this base, and every time I get close, they raise it on me.
Hussein's had his balls blown off. I want to see.
I can't do this anymore.
You think this is a big fat joke?
Holy Moses.
No difference between me and you. Me, happy, 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 dead. You, worry, worry, worry. Dead.
You see the difference?
Okay, Catch 22. Luke Turner, were you familiar with the book or Mike Nichols' adaptation before you saw this?
Yeah, I was obsessed with Catch 22 when I was an angry teenager. I read it a couple of times.
Yeah.
I actually really liked that film version back in the day.
Right.
I can't remember it apart from the bit where the man gets chopped in half standing on a life raft, which was quite grim. but I've seen two episodes now, and I'm kind of into it. I think it's sort of I remember the book just in a collection of different scenes because that's sort of how it works. Mm. And I keep the scenes they're using keep coming back. The very recognisable things. I think the Milo Minderbinder with his lamb chops and his tomatoes is great. Colonel Cathcart is kind of how I'd imagine him. Can't remember what the Hugh Laurie one, but Hugh Laurie's brilliant. Major de Coverley, he's great.
Quites and his,
it's really well filmed. I like the way that the action sequences when they're in the air being with flak all around them are all exactly the same. You get a real sense of the kind of monotony but the absolute terror of flying and fighting. And I was sort of not expecting to think they'd be able to pull it off, but for whatever reason I'm really into it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, what apparently is different about this is because the novel is not chronological, but they've made this a chronological TV series, so somehow kind of maybe flattened it out. But in 2019, do we need this to say the horrors of war? It's insane, man, inhumanity to man.
Yeah, I think that's a message that you should keep going, particularly in a time when you've got, you know, so much remembrance has been completely co-opted by nationalism and jingoism and, you know, poppy commemorations and so on has become a sort of right-wing tool rather than actually remembering the absurdity and the brutality of a war. And I think I didn't catch. I think it is timely. I think the sort of absolute pointlessness of it. And Milo Minderbinder is such a great character because he's able to sort of do that. Basically, all war is a means of marketing and an engine of capitalism.
Yes.
Point in a really funny way, you know. And it, you could argue it's a bit naff, but I think it really works.
Mm-hmm. Now, Clooney likes stories of military and authoritarian figures, doesn't he? He mentions there at Goats, barks orders in Coen Brothers movies and stuff. He is the training commander Scheibeskopf in this. Does he pull it off? Is he like the novel character when you read him, Luke?
I thought the opening bit when they're in the training camp was really good. That his kind of he just can't stand these young recruits who've come to sort of annoy him, and they're never going to be up to his immaculate standards. So I'm not a sort of great George Clooney head in any way, but I thought he did a good job of it. Yeah,
he's obviously part of the way that they can get the money and they get it produced and all that sort of thing. But he's not necessarily playing a starring role.
No, he's not come back. Yeah,
Kevin, what did you make of it?
Well, I haven't read the book and I wasn't familiar with the film that you were talking about either. So, and it's not really my era. I don't watch TV series like this. I felt it was a bit flat. I thought the air sequences with the raids were amazing, actually. Mm-hmm. Really incredible, because a lot of that must have been CGI.
Yes.
And they pulled that off really well. The monotony, as Luke's saying, about the another run, and then the, you know, the sort of inanity of war and the rules, and they say, oh, we're going to up the bombing run, and, you know, he's counting down the number of runs he's got left, and then all of a sudden they've got more on top, and, you know, just that ridiculous is why we're doing this was pushed home. But I found it really flat. The lead character, sorry, I've completely forgotten his name.
You're sorry, Ian.
When he sees his friend die,
spoiler.
There was a scene afterwards directly where they're kind of all in the water, and it was just, there was nothing there. There was no sort of, he was just like, oh, he was there and he was gone. And I didn't feel anything, no pathos with what I was watching at all. There was no emotion there for me. I found it really flat.
Right. That's one of the things I quite liked about it, though, because it's, I to my shame, I'd never properly read the book. I sort of dipped in and out when I was a teenager, and, you know, so I think it's the kind of book you should read when you're a teenager. I'm reading it properly now, and I'm amazed at how modern it is, because everything, you know, people react the way the people of 2019 would react, with kind of great blankness in the face of big events. And, Sean, you were saying it's been sort of, the chronological setup of the book has been flattened out and made chronological.
Absolutely, yes.
Which it has, but it doesn't feel that way because, events repeat themselves, events recur, the same setups between different characters are repeated over and over, with the message that war is not just hell, it's also really boring. Mm. You know, it is a more sophisticated vision of the futility and foolishness of war, but more than that, the futility and foolishness of being in large organisations, which do this kind of thing. And I think my inkling is that, I mean, it reads really like a book of the impending counterculture. You can feel the run-up to the hippies is happening. It's actually a Jack Kerouac-y sort of flavour that you've got, where people are beginning to lose their faith in institutions and authority. They're beginning to see the absurdity. And so many of these setups have the feeling of like something drafted in from Italian farce or surrealistic theatre. You know, you're allowed to come and see me when I'm not here, but you won't be there. Yeah. Yes, that's the only time you'll ever come to see me.
Yes.
There's a great line in the book, which I hope is going to appear later in the show, where the odious, appalling Captain Black is appointed a senior intelligence officer and decides that means he's the most intelligent person in the army. Full of great gags like that.
I can't remember the books. It's like 20 years since already, but it's striking me that in the film, a lot of the dialogue is lifted from the book.
What I was going to say.
Is the dialogue true to the book? Because it's really snappy. And people don't
remember the book
like that,
being
generally
very snappy.
Yes.
I mean, when Dr. Neeker's explaining Catch 22, which is just, it's just brilliant. And he's really good as well. The Dr. Neeker character in
he's really good. Yeah.
He's exactly as it seems in the book, definitely.
It's paradox heavy, and the book is like that. I mean, but that's one thing that jarred with me, having started reading the book. Yossarian is a wisecracker. He's really, really sharp. He's bright. And yet we have Christopher Rabbit, who looks like Marlon Brando. Mm. And it's like, that's nice. Looks a bit like a Levi's ad. And the homoerotic bits, when they're all in the sea and looking at each other's bodies and wondering about war, I thought, this could have gone in a different direction. I'm not sure. I'm convinced by the Christopher Abbott character. I think he's too good looking.
I always imagine Yossarian being pretty hot, actually, as a teenager. I had a total crush on him. there was something about his kind of, like, his sort of nihilism and his despair and his desperation to get out. And I sort of sensed he was quite an attractive man.
Mm. But I don't know if they've got the wit.
But I wanted think more despair. Like, why did it... You know, obviously he's madness because they're going to war, but I wanted more despair of him to say, why have you just suddenly decided you can't do this anymore?
But then you just end up with somebody going, why? Yeah. Like that, and then...
There's that early scene, isn't there? You say that they don't chop around like the book does, but the very, very first scene of the first episode was obviously a flash forward to some kind of airbase raid, and there's a guy naked wandering out screaming, and everything's on fire and everyone's screaming.
Yeah, but I actually think updating the Yossarian character like that to make him less of a kind of, you know, existential Bilko, Alan Elder in MASH, with a wisecrack for every occasion, that I don't think would land very well now.
No.
Because I think you want to say, we like our central characters to now to be wandering around in a daze of confusion and, you know, abyssal despair.
I see. What about the lady characters I was worrying about, said the lady in the audience. We've got the nurse and we've got some prostitutes and we've got the wife of.
You say war is sexist. You say we need more female representation in war. Send more women in the war. That's the best thing.
No, but as we well know, women did have a place in the war and they worked very hard and they were true, rounded characters. And this says, and some of the actresses in this have said, it's much better than the book. It's much better than the film. They've made our characters a bit better. And yet it's still a homoerotic Levi's commercial.
But it's about a world of men, and you're lucky, Sean, because in a Grand Catch 22 scenario, you've never actually spent time in a world of men. A world of men can be really bloody boring.
I spent time at the Select magazine offices.
because when you're there,
a world of men
on the front line.
Catch 22, yeah, Sean. Catch 22.
Really difficult.
When you're there, it's not exclusively a world of men because you're a lady, so you change it by your presence. That's the Catch 22.
I think it is that difficult. But last time I was on, we were talking about Daz Boot, and they did really bringing in the kind of French resistance, and that was actually kind of the better story. Yeah, the better storyline than the World of Men one. But I think when you're adapting something like Catch 22, it's quite hard to suddenly start inventing lots of female characters and give them strong roles. Unfortunately, just the sort of way it is. I mean, there's a whole chapter in the book called Nately's Whore, isn't there? And she's like smacking him on the head with her heel, which was
spoiler
with a shoe. But so maybe that was a feminist statement. I don't know.
To be fair to Joseph Heller and the adaptation, all of the male characters are caricatures and monsters, and they are, you know Captain Black is clearly a Joseph McCarthy character in embryo. You know, everybody is, and that's why it's a great work of satire, everybody is a caricature that gets twisted. So, yes, a lot of the small handful of female characters are also caricatures, but this is the absurdity of war. Mm. It's like asking for the realism in a...
I'm saying a stronger character, or maybe one that has a different sort of input.
Possibly.
So there are all bit prosies. There we go.
They're all prosies.
Loads of eye candy for the women.
That is true. Does the streaming format... So we're in the world of the miniseries. This is a six-parter, is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
If I'm wrong. Does this mean that novels can be adapted to miniseries much better than you could for a 90-minute film? Are we now going to see some... Hey, Ulysses! It's on Hulu.
Oh, my God, can you imagine Ulysses?
Bloody brilliant, yeah.
Mm. I'm sure it's better suited to a TV series, yeah. That's a book like this, definitely.
Absolutely, and I think, you could then go on.
I really hope it's a massive flop because I do not want Catch 23. I don't want the handmade taleization of this. And then they go somewhere else, whoever's not dead.
As we know, fact fans, it was called Catch 18 originally when Joseph Heller took it to the publishers and they went, no, there's another book that's got 18 in the title, so it's called Catch 22.
And the 22 because 22 is repetitive, isn't it? And the repetitive nature of the whole thing.
Well, he wanted it to be Catch 18. Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
The music. You mentioned the music, Sean.
Yes. The music, I thought, was slightly bland.
I didn't even notice it.
It's swing, it's... Yes, who is George's aunt. Also, it's very of that moment. And I thought, well, you missed a trick in the sort of Peaky Blinders sense, maybe. That if there had been more of a counterpoint, it wouldn't have made it so sort of luscious and wonderful.
Oh, you don't want this with Vampire Bloody Weekend. Can you imagine this with Billie Eilish?
They were drifting up the field at Glastonbury this weekend. It was bloody awful. I had a heat stroke.
I didn't say Vampire Bloody Weekend.
No, I mean, I found that kind of... Actually, honestly, I didn't notice the music. And then you said the swing thing. Right. I was like, oh, yeah, of course I did. And I mean, it's not my sort of thing, but I'm quite glad they stuck with period music. music, to be honest, rather than try to... I mean, I'm not actually seeing Peaky Blinders, but look at Nick Cave and things.
Yes,
I don't know.
EJ Harvey.
Yeah, but I don't know whether that would have quite worked, because it is like the colour tone and all the uniform details. I mean, the period detail is incredible, so I think you kind of had to have that music.
And also the jauntiness of swing, underscoring the banality of, come on, guys, red, white, blue, we're going to win this war. I think it's absolutely spot on.
I thought
on.
That was just a bit hammer over the head, but that is me, isn't it?
Yeah, I think contemporary music would have taken it.
You were there.
You mansplaining war to me.
And war-splaining.
War-splaining. Anyone going to watch any more?
Yeah.
I reckon?
All the way.
Yeah. All the way, really?
I'm racing through the book to see if I can, like, because I hate...
catch up.
I hate seeing things when I haven't read the book. I even read the book of Jurassic Park before it came out. Yeah. That's how pathetic I am. So I'm racing as fast as I can to read. But no, I'm really, really enjoying it, and I think one of the great things about it is they do, you know, the TV series just complement the book rather than ruining it and simplifying it.
I must say I'm enjoying the book a bit more than the series, but
I'm enjoying it a lot more than I thought I would.
Yeah. Kafka-esque.
Absolutely. Anyway, if you like Big Mouth, you'll definitely enjoy another of our podcasts, Be There with Dali Loudspeakers, where we dig into the stories behind the great recordings in collaboration with Dali, manufacturers of exquisite speakers based on high-end performance and beautiful Danish design. In this week's episode, Big Mouth regular, Bowie biographer and former Mojo editor Paul Trinker discusses the evolving sonics of David Bowie, and Sean's on this one too. Here's a snippet of Paul with a somewhat controversial opinion of where Bowie's talent came from. Search Be There with Dali on your favourite podcast app to get the full show, and don't forget to subscribe.
A lot of people disagreed with me, but I find him a fascinating character because I believe he wasn't born inherently talented. I think he learned, he constructed himself. So when we talk about all those different personae, what the most important persona he built was David Bowie. He was David Jones. He used to be the sax player and didn't look particularly cool. His mate George Underwood was the cool one, and he built it up bit by bit. He learned how to sing, and then he learned how to sing in a studio via Shel Talmy. And, you know, people overlooked that, but it's Shel Talmy who basically said, look, first take, second take, if not, forget it. And that went all the way through. So he was just learning all these bits and piecing it together. And I think he felt regret that he wasn't inherently talented. He was jealous of Mark Bolan. He blanked, you know, George Underwood in the street because George was more talented than him. But by constructing this talent, it was something, therefore, that he could reshape later on. And what better act of creation is there than to first create yourself before you create all that body of music? And that's what he did.
That was a bit of the latest Be There podcast. Search your favourite podcast app for Be There with Dali and subscribe for a bit more. It's like Big Mouth, only it's more techie. OK, then let's get back to music. We always ask our guests to bring in something to delight, inspire and or terrify the listeners. Luke Turner, what have you got and what's it all about?
I've got a new track by Carter Tutti Void, which is Chris Carter and Cozy Fanny Tutti, ex of Throbbing Gristle, and Nick Void, who was in Factory Floor, one of my favourite of the recent generation groups. And I absolutely love this trio. They formed as a one-off gig for Mute Records, Short Circuit Celebrations at the Roundhouse. It was one of the most intense and joyous and warm, euphoric gigs I've ever seen in a tiny Roundhouse room. And it was only going to be a one-off. They released that as an album, and now they're on their third record. They just keep putting this music out, and I just find it's, you know, they're from, all three of them are from quite extreme backgrounds or whatever, but it's something about this that I find it's kind of like sensual dance music with a really gritty bit in the middle, and I love them.
Fantastic. This is T3.5 by Carter Tutti Void. Hands in the air, waving like you just don't care for Carter Tutti Void. Finally, Tom York has put a new album out last week. He did it without warning, and I think at this stage, the most Radiohead thing to do will be to commission a six-month marketing campaign in partnership with an energy drink, because these surprise releases are becoming less and less surprising. Anyway, Anima follows on from his Suspiria soundtrack. It's accompanied by a short film by Paul Thomas Anderson, which depicts York and his new partner Dejana Roncioni in a kind of 1984 wage slave dystopia type of scenario. What do we think of it? Is it going to fill the Radiohead-shaped hole in many lives? And how does his claustrophobic electronica measure up to the way the music of Bleeps is going these days? This, I think, is the best track. This is Dawn Chorus.
Back up the cul-de-sac. Come on, do your work. job again. And your train of thought.
Soft focused, indeterminate sounds of Tom York there, produced by Nigel Godrich as usual. I found that particular track quite moving. You can't hear it without thinking that it's addressed to his ex-partner, Rachel Owen, who Tom York split up with in 2016 and who subsequently died of cancer. Kev, what are you on Radiohead and Tom York?
I'm not a fan at all. I have a massive problem with Tom York's voice, so I've never warmed to him or Radiohead, unfortunately. But I actually like this a lot more than I thought I would. If only he didn't sing. It sounds to me like he's been listening to Forte or Floating Points, and it's very, very competent musically. I actually really enjoyed it musically, but yeah. Pretty much whenever he opens his mouth, I start to go, oh, God.
Yeah, he's kind of he and Radiohead have been absorbing warpy type things for like knocking on 20 years now, haven't they?
Yeah.
And one of the criticisms is, you know, you get more attention for this because of your brand name, and actually were it to come out under, you know, the name of Sinewave 3000 or whatever, yes. It would probably be, you know, if it competed on its own terms, it might not be really seen as so great. How do you think it fits into the competitive set, as it were?
I think it's really up there. Yep. Absolutely. I mean, but I would go to Forte or Floating Points for this kind of thing. I wouldn't go to Tom York. Because he has that thing with it where he sings, where he kind of starts a sentence and then, you know, and he whimpers and he whines. And there's a track later on where I think he's singing, I thought we had a deal, but it sounds like he's saying, I thought we had a deer.
So maybe they have a deer. I don't know.
I did actually see some lyrics for one of the songs. I don't know if they were the actual things that was on the YouTube comments thing. And they were utter rubbish. Well, just total bollocks.
Really. That is actually his thing, though, isn't it? It's not, you know, he's been doing his utmost not to write a song since Creep. Mm. And the lyrics are all random snippets that make Burroughs cut-ups seem, you know, coherent and direct. Which, of course, Burroughs cut-ups were coherent and direct. They were designed to feel random but have something to say. He sifted them afterwards. You know, Tom seems to, you know, throw words into a kind of one of those wind tunnel things. You know, you run in, you're supposed to grab as many £5 notes as you can. And then that becomes the lyric. But from it emerges a mood.
A miserable mood.
Yes, he's a whingy, whiny. And he's not a good singer. That's the trouble as well. He hasn't got a great range or great voice. And it just doesn't do it for me vocally. There are some really good tunes there, though. I loved Twist. I thought Twist was great.
Yeah. I mean, there is some, you know, there is, you're never under any doubt who you're listening to. It sounds like, it's him from that world. Yeah. It raises the question of, you know, not something that strikes us, well, what are Radiohead doing on those records? Because obviously those Radiohead records are created by the band and they have a fullness, whether you like them or not, and I tend to really like them, they have a fullness that his own stuff tends not to have.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Luke, you're a massive fan, aren't you? Tell me, what did you make?
I mean, I liked it more than I thought I was going to. I agree with Kev. It's just always been that, his whiny voice and his lyrics are crap and it's just the sort of same, oh, here's some scattered thoughts and dystopian words. Makes you think, he's sort of like the Banksy of pompous electronic music. And, I mean, to me, it sounded like a very beige version of Liars, a band I really love, who have gone further and further left field. And he sounds a bit like Angus Andrew. And I know Radiohead are massive Liars fans, which is interesting, as much as the kind of warp stuff they pick up on. The song about I Thought We Had a Deal, I thought was quite a good song. There's two or three that I was like, oh, actually, this is, I like the song. Do it a different singer.
There's some very good melodies.
Which I wasn't expecting necessarily was the kind of the top end melody stuff.
Yeah.
So I liked him when I thought I was going to. But, you know, I was, one of my favourite ever gigs will always remain Radiohead at Glastonbury 97. I loved OK Computer, but I was an overly serious 18-year-old and I've just grown out of them completely. There's not many bands I've gone off in such a spectacular fashion as Radiohead, and everything around them, just it's just always so like, hey, yeah, all our stuff's been leaked, but yeah, we're going to sell it all and give it to Extinction Rebellion. It's just like, I mean, I just can't help be cynical, which is all, and it makes me feel bad about myself.
See, I wrote a piece about that for the New Statesman, so listened to quite a lot of it, and it was actually very enjoyable because you can hear them enjoying themselves.
Blimey. Having a laugh.
Well, not exactly.
Did you listen to all 18 hours?
No. I listened to probably about 5 or 6 hours of it. But it's not possible to listen to 18 hours, certainly not with a deadline like they gave me. But, you know, it was never designed to be listened to at all.
I like the fact that the guy tried to hold him to ransom and they went, oh,
I thought it was good.
You know, we'll sell it for
so they're having fun. Week. They're not exactly raping rubber chickens at each other and sort of putting on googly eyes, but they're rocking out and grooving. You hear the songs taking shape. What I find troublesome with this is that, and I think you're saying you grew out of it, it's very hard for him to let any joy into his life. And there is joy to be found on Radiohead records. In Rainbows is a very joyful record. King of Limbs less so, but the last one, Moonshaped Pool, I found very kind of uplifting in its own sad way. And this is just a bit, yeah, look at the state of the world, you know. Sean, what did you think?
I enjoyed it at the beginning. The first three songs, to say Twist is an amazing song. Really beautiful, and I could listen to that on a loop. He does what... It's absolutely completely expected. It's not... Yeah. There's nothing surprising. So the layers are just beautiful. It's just beautifully produced. But by the middle, you're just thinking, I need a different tone. I need something else because it is all on the same street.
A different singer. Get Sylvia Mason-James in.
I don't think necessarily. I think we're being quite harsh on him. He knows what his voice is like and he's trying to use it instrumentally. He's trying to use it in a different way. Mm. And I think, well, that's good. At least he's not doing shit rock songs. That would be a bad thing. He's obviously trying not to do Creep every single song that he does. But it's too miserable. By the end of it, it's a bit, you know, should we just all jump out the window? I just felt tonally, it does need the rubber chicken in the middle.
I think comedy sound effect.
I think Dawn Chorus is, although formerly a sad song, is so beautiful that it makes you happy. Mm. You know, it is a very, very beautiful piece of music. But I get what you mean. What do we think of the film?
I love that your email said, oh, it'll explain a lot in inverted commas. If you can interpret modern contemporary dance, yes.
Mm. So the gist is, we're on a tube train in an unnamed European city with a bunch of worker drones, all of whom are sort of twitching in a desultory manner on their way to work for the man. And Tom and a female worker, played by Tom's actual real-life girlfriend, they kind of wake up to the reality, yeah? They think about it, sheeple, and they kind of... the wincing on Luke. What did you think, Luke? Did you enjoy this?
Thankfully, I didn't have a chance to watch it because I was out last night and I had to go straight for work, so I'm very sorry I didn't get a chance to watch it. I must admit, when you said it explains it, I was like, oh, God. And then now you've described it, it would probably have made me hate the album because it's so patronising, isn't it? Hey, guys, there's that Banksy thing again. Oh, look, if only you all just realised. Yeah. I'm singing the truth through my art.
They did a spoof on Select many, many years ago when I wasn't there, which was like made up titles for Richard Ashcroft albums or songs rather. And one of the song titles was "Money Makes You Poor." But there is a little bit "Money Makes You Poor." It is a lot of twitching contemporary dance directed by I keep calling him Paul Trouble Anderson. It'd be much better if he was Paul Thomas Anderson.
It's definitely well made.
It's beautifully made.
It didn't make me love the album anymore. Yeah. It made me more annoyed than
it starts with the desolate Eastern European train carriage and you can tell everyone's a dancer because they're all sitting up straight and things like that really not their core is very, very strong. That was really, really annoying. I know they're going to dance. I know, I'm just waiting for when they're going to do that dance which puts me off modern life.
The point where they're on the sort of near vertical floor.
So that's good, technically, obviously there's a floor moving and you're wondering what gravity is.
And also, Tom is dancing in his own way.
In his brain map.
It is a bit hypocritical to sort of, for somebody like me to go to the dancing because we should dance like no one's looking and Tom is dancing like no one's looking. You know, they sort of tried to reprise a Winston and Julia thing. Breaking out.
He said 1984, it's completely that. Powers that be, man.
Yeah. Yeah. But it is a bit make you think, isn't it?
But can we just say, he doesn't need to sell records. He's probably got some money, hasn't he? So he is doing this out of the love of doing
it. He's doing it out of wanting to do it, yeah.
And there's not necessarily a populist strand going through that. And I think that's to be applauded.
And he's also not doing the song to camera, the band behind him. Yeah. You know, that's got to be applauded.
I mean, I kind of enjoyed this record. I love Dawn Chorus and I will be playing that a lot. I found parts of it, as you say, Sean, it's just one note and it runs on, it hammers that note a little bit too far. But what it made me think, and often Radiohead's recent records have made me think this too, is, you know, don't disparage the writing of a Creep. don't disparage the writing of A My Eye and Lung. It's a lot harder to write a song which crystallises and expresses a true piece of feeling than it is to create a kind of swatch of drum and bass without the bass, yes, and some skittering, pittering patterns and a throb of analogue synthesizer and go, Bob's your art, you know. It's a lot harder to be Neil Tennant, you know what I mean? With an idea and a song. And I just think I would love Radiohead to go, you know what, we've gone out into the lands of weird, and perhaps it's time we did sort of try to revisit
the anthem,
the original song, and reinvent songwriting rather than abandon songwriting.
I think that's a really good point. You know, I can't stand Coldplay, but I would always give Chris Martin credit, because those kind of songs that he's so good at are impossible. Like getting Mercury, you know, mercurial songs. And I would love it if Radiohead kind of at one point went, we inspired all these mopey indie bands who've got massive, like Coldplay. I mean, there was that sort of direct lineage. Let's just show them how to do really good songs, but with some weird stuff around it. Yeah. And I'd be like, welcome back, Radiohead. I'd love it if they did that.
I've also thought that Coldplay were kind of like, they're like the decaffeinated Radiohead, or they're the Sliding Doors Radiohead, you know, where could have gone in this direction, decided to go in the other direction.
It's like
the
band
Gwyneth Paltrow. Yeah. Very Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yes,
it's almost
Doors.
Like the band split in two in a kind of, you know, science fiction, you know, schism type of thing. But you're right, it would be very interesting, because, I mean, there is no doubting the sonic adventurism of Tom York, or the musicianship of everybody in Radiohead.
Mm.
There you go. There's your homework, Radiohead, if you're listening.
We're getting a bit, they went to university.
I'd like to hear a Johnny Greenwood solo album more.
Well, he's done them.
He's done soundtracks, hasn't he?
Mm. Yeah. He needs to do something with some proper leather-lunged divas, is what he needs.
Anyway.
That'd be great.
Yeah, like I say, Sylvia Mason-James. Okay, we've got time for Kev's track. Strictly Kev, what tune have you brought in to recommend to us?
It's Vanishing Twin on Fire Records, yes, which is now the home of Jane Weaver as well, mm-hmm, and Death and Vanilla. They've got a new album out called At the Age of Immunology, which I think is number two in the Quietest.
Yeah, we love this record. It's brilliant.
It's amazing. Mm-hmm. Why They're Not Bigger is anyone's...
Mm. Oh, well, we'll fix that. They're on Big Mouth now. They'll be massive, yeah.
But I saw them a couple of weeks ago in Brighton at the upstairs of a pub, about 50 people there, and 2 days later they're supporting Stereolab in London at 70% Empire. And they're amazing. There's... Stereolab and Broadcast are the obvious comparisons, but they're way broader than that. They're much more cosmic. They're more Sun Ra, definitely.
Are you saying they're broad, they're broader than Broadcast? You are, aren't you?
You said that.
And they got one of the best drummers I've ever seen, Valentina. God, she's incredible. Plays in so many... She's in Tamaga as well, plays in all sorts of bands.
She was
in
The Oscillation.
Amazing.
She's just this tiny little woman that is... You've just got to watch her. She's amazing. She's having a ball when she's drumming. She's screaming and just laughing and just incredible.
Fantastic. And the track is called?
Track is called Chronic Suspension May Save Your Life.
Cryonic suspension may save your life. Excellent. Well, we will do the Walt Disney freeze yourself for future medical trials after this tune. And that's the end of the show, which means closing time chatter. What will our guests be discussing over a glass of activated stevia juice with Tom York in order to take his mind off everything? Luke Turner, what will you be telling Tom about?
I'd say to him, right, Tom, you know you think you're making weird music. You're not making weird music. You need to listen to my dear colleague and friend John Doran's Radio 4 programme, not podcast, programme, New Weird Britain, which was a four-part thing on Radio 4, Monday lunchtimes. And it was looking at... the music we're kind of into at The Quietest, which people always say, oh, The Quietest writing about bins falling downstairs again, etc. But to us, this is music that is, you know, very vital. It's about... made a lot of time with people to sort of deal with mental health issues around sexuality. It's made by people who've kind of gone, I can't make any money doing this in the mainstream. I'm not going to live in London. I'm not going to try and engage with the music industry. I'm going to be in the Calder Valley, somewhere up in the hills, and I'm just going to make this music, put it on Bandcamp, put on Crazy Happenings, collaborate with people. And it's this wonderful, fertile underground that we felt, you know, we write about it, so a couple of other places do, but it just doesn't get taken seriously. You know, a lot of the time the media will kind of have this like patronising tone of, oh, it's a bit weird, And we think it's not that weird. You can get into it because a lot of this, it's so intense or fun or ridiculous that this is actually quite accessible. And it was brilliant. You know, I felt like it was quite an achievement from The Quiet as well, just listening to Radio 4 on, and you got stuff like Guttersnipe, who are this intense sort of like heavy, weird noise group from the north playing out on a Monday afternoon.
Right before the Archers.
Right. It was a couple of hours before the Archers, yeah. But so I would say, Tom York, come on, this is really weird music. Stop, put your Warp catalogue aside for a bit. Stop ripping it off. Listen to some Gazelle Twins, some Guttersnipe, some Lone Taxidermist, some Richard Skelton, some Chris and Cozy, these sorts of artists. And, you know, that's the true kind of, I think, eccentricity, but not in a, oh, look at me, wacky way.
So Gazelle Twins on it, she's greater.
Yeah, properly. She's absolutely brilliant. Very divisive. And I saw her at the Sea Change Festival, and she does this whole album, Pastoral, which is all about kind of the twisted countryside, how the chocolate box vision of the British countryside is complete nonsense, and it's full of death. And she's moved there because it's cheap, and she can't afford to live in a city. She's had experienced lots of kind of dodgy Brexit vibes, because she's got a European-sounding surname. And when she takes her kids to nursery school, it's all this sort of, like, slightly nasty chat. But Sea Change, she sort of comes on with this sort of crazy jester's outfit, and it's really, really heavy, heavy electronic music. And half the audience left. The other half were really into it. You know, and I like that. I love music that is divisive between in that way.
Luke, we're supposed to be bringing Britain together. Do you not know this? This is what Boris Johnson's going to do. Shut up about politics, Andrew. Strictly Kev, what's your closing time chatter? What are you going to tell Tom about?
I think he needs to chill out. So I'm going to get him to watch the YouTube videos on restoring old tools or toys. There's this really lovely restoration videos that have been going up online where someone will wordlessly and soundlessly, apart from the sounds of the tools, restore a rusted old Jeep, toy Jeep, to its former glory in the space of 15 minutes, with all the tools like sandblasting and drilling and riveting and powder coating, painting it. And these are the most ambient things I've ever seen in my life. They're so calming to watch.
Is it like a sort of a mini, sort of quickly imbibed version of those 8-hour films of train journeys through Sweden?
It is. But the great thing is there's no music and there's no annoying voiceover saying, now we're going to powder coat this, and to do this we're going to put a current thrill and all this sort of shit.
The great thing about it is there's no music on it, says DJ Strictly.
DIY SOS.
It's
really slow and ambient.
I think it's
I watched a couple. The powder coating's beautiful. Yeah. I could just watch people powder coating things all day now.
I think like I said that. On the email before the show, it sounds like the ASMR DIY SOS. You know, just vibe out. Obviously the next iteration of this is going to be somebody's going to take those 15-minute videos and stretch them out to 3 hours long, so you just get them. Stan Pattenden, what's your closing time chatter?
I'm not going to be cheering Tom York up, I'm afraid. One of the things about doing this show is great because it's new stuff, but we don't always come back to what we've done. Mm-hmm. So I've now watched all of Chernobyl, that's what I was going to say.
Wow.
And oh my God. So we watched the first one for the show. It's grim, obviously. I gave it a bit of a rest. A couple of people said, come on, keep watching. Yeah. Just, I want to say what an amazing miniseries.
It's great, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. There are bits that haunt me still. I am agog at the amount of detail, but also the way they can dramatise a real life thing like that, the way it turns it into fiction, but it's for the good. And the end, where it talks about the real life characters in it, I just thought it was exemplary, is the word that I would use, like a school teacher. I was just absolutely blown away by it.
And I want to revise.
And so I really want to say, keep up with Chernobyl. Yeah. If you saw one or two, just, it's incredible.
And I want to revise my criticism of it on the show, which was,
that's how I felt.
Episode one. It, you know, you discover in no way why or how any of this is happening. You just don't know.
You're
why
thrown into the disaster, right?
And my complaint about it was, well, what the hell is going on here? You're just showing me an unrelated series of people running down corridors and being frightened. But the final episode, the courtroom drama, where Legasov explains everything with the red and the blue cards, it was clearly constructed with that in mind.
And it is
works brilliantly.
It didn't happen Yeah. I quite like that. There is one scene that just I will never forget, and you then go back in the last episode and you see the young guys, but you've already kind of been through the journey. You've seen them die. And there's a point where one of the young guys, he's 25, and they keep ribbing him for being 25. He is visited by Emily Watson, I think, in episode 2 or 3 in the hospital, and she asks how old he is, and he says, I'm 25, and he looks like he's 150. The bits like that, there are just bits that keep coming back and jarring. I just thought it was absolutely...
I didn't see it, but I heard about the soundtrack, and it was all recorded in a power plant, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I listened to that online. It was incredible.
Yeah, all of it fuses together so well.
And also, I'm for a thing that was on Sky Atlantic, and, you know, figures were, you know, not massively massive, but they were all, you know, watched by people who really care about this stuff. It's been great to see how bits of it have entered the language. So I've heard people going,
it was HBO's biggest series so far.
The best rated ever.
Best rated, but not necessarily a smash hit on Sky Atlantic.
Yes.
Will not be anywhere near like a Country File repeat.
Well, hopefully it will then go on to...
Yeah, it will, and take a further life in stream. But what I really like is the fact is that all these phrases from the show have entered the parlance. Mm. So I've heard people go like, how's things at work? Oh, graphite on the roof. Or I think we've got a real positive void coefficient here, i.e. the thing you're doing to try and fix the thing is going to make the thing worse.
Mm. So there's been that and years, and everyone's been going on about them, and I think I should watch these things. Everyone's watching them. But then I read the Guardian every day, and the whole homepage is just absolute doom, and there's climate change going on and heat waves, and that's all worse than we thought. And I just, I can't face going home and going, oh, I'm going to watch these two really bleak teledramas. I can't do it. I just have to go and watch, you know, nature through the eyes of the Vikings.
They're also about what we can do. They're about the mistakes and what we can do, about humanity, man. Yeah. So there's something that you gain from it that they're not so mindless.
My closing time chatter is a very short one. And this will really enrage Tom York, actually. It's the phenomenon of badly photoshopped knockoff T-shirts on Facebook. You go on Facebook and there's a picture of Peter Hook holding the worst shit Unknown Pleasures T-shirt you've ever seen in your life, complete with bad signatures from each member of New Order.
Really?
With something like, thank you for 40 years of Unknown Pleasures, essential for all fans. And people are going, this is disgusting. I can't believe Hookie would get involved in this. Look at it. It's clearly bad Photoshop. Yeah. The type on the T-shirt is... completely straight. That doesn't make any sense. Also, next to it is a picture of another famous person holding the exact same T-shirt, but with some other old shit all over it. Yeah. And I just think, A, people need to work on their Photoshop spotting skills. If you kind of think, even Peter Hook wouldn't do this, it probably is a Photoshop job. But I also, there's a slightly serious thing, which is that there's no way of reporting this. Facebook don't care. Facebook are supporting copyright theft on a grand scale.
I see it on Instagram all the time. It's like, look at this new Beastie Boys T-shirt. And everyone underneath is just going, oh, yeah, look at this, you know, tagging their mate in, not thinking, this is copyright infringement.
And also, look at this amazing new Beastie Boys T-shirt being held by Yauch.
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. Because he would definitely do that, wouldn't he, even if he were able to. Hem, he can't. So, yet again, Zuckerberg, you are listening, sort it out. Of course he will not. And that is the end of the show. Kevin Luke, you're going to stay around for the extra bit for Patreon supporters. But in the meantime, thanks for coming in. Kev, when can people and where can people see your Kraftwerk show?
Oh, God. I'm doing them all over the place at the moment.
But the answer is they should Google Strictly Kev Kraftwerk, really, shouldn't they?
They should go onto djfood.org and look at the gig list.
Okay, we'll come down and see it. Luke, where can people hear you reading from Out of the Woods? With special guest appearance by Chris Martin on acoustic guitar.
Yeah. I'm doing quite a lot of things, doing Port Elliot, Norwich Pride next week, Green Man Festival, End of the Road, quite a lot of stuff. It's all on my Twitter if people want to come and see me read about sex in trees.
Sex in trees. Stuck up a hornbeam. I like the idea of Norwich Pride. I hope Alan Partridge is going
to
be there.
I'm looking forward to Norwich Pride. I think it's going to be really good fun. Yeah.
Well, everyone, thanks for listening. Sean, thank you for being Sean.
Thank you.
And thank you, producer Sophie Black. And we'll see you all next week.